First up this evening is Dr. Tim Nadru. He's a professor of economics and a regional economic consultant that specializes in impact and investment analysis. Most of his private research focuses on energy economics and increasing the accuracy of regional economic accounts. His published research focuses on ex-ante and ex-post applied policy analysis through the use of computable general equilibrium models. He has testified to various state legislatures on topics from education to the structure of cannabis markets to the pricing of public assets. More importantly, he is the father of five baptized believing children and the leader of a men's Bible study at Washington State University, where he has, by God's grace, not been fired yet. Please welcome Dr. Tim Nadru to the podium. His talk this evening is titled Fascism by Any Other Name.
Thank you, Jeremy. Okay, Jeremy's going to distribute a handout that I have for you guys. This is mostly just to help keep things rolling because this topic is a little bit dense and I'm trying to get more in a half hour than I really actually can. So I should also say that I'm probably supposed to indemnify all of the organizations that I'm affiliated with by saying the opinions I voice here are mine and mine alone, just in case someone out there in the audience starts to think that these government universities actually have some moral scruples. I'm going to ask you guys to bear with me for just a moment. My preface to this talk is a bit longer than I would prefer. It isn't that I want to caveat everything I'm about to say, but Americans tend to hate nuance, and a discussion on monetary and fiscal policy entails having some degree of nuance. The first nuance is that modern monetary theory, or MMT, is philosophical in nature. There aren't a lot of economic equations and models associated with it the way we would find with traditional economics. But to disregard it out of hand entails throwing out the baby with the bathwater because there's a lot of truth within MMT. Both Austrian and MMT recognize the federal government is a monopolist of the currency. Both argue that the natural rate of unemployment is zero. Both argue, in effect, and want to dissolve the Federal Reserve. And none of this is said in defense of MMT. But it should suggest that our goal should be to untangle the Gordian knot of truth and lies, preserve what is true, and disregard the rest. The second reason for the preface is that bad philosophy needs to be studied carefully so that it can be summarily destroyed. Many of you have heard some version of the refrain that conservatives have conserved nothing. Had they, for instance, studied and destroyed Alfred Kinsey's perverted and crap science, maybe we wouldn't be cutting off children's genitals today. That's a failure of conservatives. Had we studied and intellectually curb-stomped Giovanni Gentile's actual idealism, maybe 500,000 or so Italians and Ethiopians wouldn't have been murdered by Mussolini. That was a failure of conservatives. Perhaps if we had done the same thing with Margaret Sanger, well, you guys get the point. God might draw straight with crooked lines, but our apathy towards bad philosophy is the crooked line we ought to be focused on. Conservatives, libertarians, Austrians, but predominantly Christians need to be weeding intellectual gardens as much as they need to be weeding spiritual ones. So my objective here is to take MMT as seriously as we can, understand its tenets, and then refute those philosophical assumptions that contradict reality. Many, in fact, nearly all economists in academia are arrayed against MMT. Rarely has anything brought the economics profession together in such a resounding fashion. Paul Krugman and Greg Mankiw, enemies at the best of times, have both written refutations of MMT. Austrians, monetarists, neoclassicists, neo-Keynesians, freshwater, saltwater, and any other descriptor of economic philosophy has had their champions critique MMT, and all have found it wanting. But remember to look at the incentives of the critics as well. If MMT is adopted as true, what does that entail for the old guard? This again is why we must be discerning in our critique. There is a built-in incentive to preserve the status quo even when it is wrong. It is just that in this particular case, it isn't wrong. Why, if the economics discipline has rejected MMT, is it still a threat? MMT is being fed not by the journals and the academics, but by Washington. Keynes rightly said, the idea of economists and political philosophers, both when they are right and when they are wrong, are more powerful than is commonly understood. Indeed, the world is ruled by little else. Practical men who believe themselves to be quite exempt from any intellectual influence are usually the slaves of some defunct economist. And defunct here is the right word. MMT's greatest contribution is that it provides an opportunity for politicians to gain even more control over the money supply. Why would men that grasp for power reject a theory that offers them more of it? I'm not defending our current market structures regarding money, other than to say the system that we have at present is substantially better than the one recommended by MMT. I have to admit that MMT is an interesting philosophy, filled with interesting thought experiments. And it plays to our egos because we imagine that we can design a level and form of government that will mitigate the idleness of economic resources and put us on a steeper growth trajectory. As Christians, we want that. Part of rolling back the curse is spreading the abundance of the garden into every corner of the earth. The teleology of economics is to slay the dragon of poverty. That drive towards abundance and beauty needs to be understood on God's terms and not man's. Hayek unwittingly calls us back to our Christian humility when he says, quote, "The curious task of economics is to demonstrate to men how little they really know about what they imagine they can design. I can't do it better than the criminals that came before me." So what is MMT? Modern monetary theory might make one think of neo-monetarists, as one might think of neoclassicists or neo-Keynesians, but that is not it at all. It has nothing to do with the theories that Milton Friedman championed. At its core, MMT is Keynesian writ large, in that it focuses on the fiscal actions of government coupled with monetary authority. Stephanie Kelton herself says that the strong form of Keynesianism, supported by A.P. Lerner, he's one that developed functional finance, does not go far enough for MMT. MMT argues that fiscal policy, that's the taxing, borrowing, and spending, should drive economic activity, and monetary policy should finance those efforts. This vision is not inconsistent with strict constitutionalists. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution says, quote, "The Congress shall have power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. Congress shall have the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States." All of that so far is fiscal. It has some discussion of commerce and naturalization, and then it says, "Congress shall have the authority to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standards of weights and measures." That's all monetary power. So the Constitution gives both monetary and fiscal authority to Congress. As of right now, the Federal Reserve exercises monetary control, which many of us in the economics profession would say poses an additional check and balance on the authority of Congress and the president. Just as an aside, think about what happened in the 1970s under Paul Volcker. He goes through strict monetary contraction, right? We had 50% unemployment in large cities and 30% unemployment nationwide during the '70s. I'm confusing the Great Depression here and the 1970s recession. Volcker's contraction caused interest rates to skyrocket and bankrupted a lot of farmers. Okay. The unspoken word was that he was going to break inflation no matter how many people he broke. Okay. No matter how many people he bankrupted. And he bankrupted a lot. And it's because inflation was over 10% at the time. There was no appetite for him in Congress. Right. It was because of the independence of the Federal Reserve that he was able to actually conquer inflation. The existence of the Federal Reserve also enforces a sharp distinction now between monetary and fiscal policy. Where the Constitution clearly delineates the two, professional economists want to preserve that distinction. MMT wants fiscal policy to drive monetary policy, which would ultimately be detrimental to America's interests. As part of MMT's reuniting of monetary and fiscal authority, it is seeking to remove any constraints on Congress's ability to govern the economy. They're advocating, actively advocating, the complete removal of the debt ceiling, which they've kind of done de facto anyways, a removal of PAYGO, which is Congress's method for ensuring that new bills have financing for them, as well as the Byrd Rule, which is the Senate's rules for reconciliation bills between the budgets passed by the House and the Senate. This is all designed to remove any constraints on federal legislative spending. The first tenet of MMT is that a sovereign fiat currency issuing monopolist, which our government is, can never be insolvent. Their argument is that we face no fiscal constraints because we cannot default on our debt. Larry Ray says, for most governments, there is no default risk on government debt. Even though we have history of nation after nation defaulting on debt, they're saying it can't happen anymore. This time it's different, guys. You'll hear MMT economists argue that there is a difference between being an issuer of the currency and being a user of the currency. There's a lot of truth in this, just as it was true in the Weimar Republic. In order to pay war reparations, Germany just printed Reichsmarks. In our case, we could just print the money necessary for paying off Social Security liabilities. See? No insolvency. We just print more. The first and obvious objection is inflation. Inflation is the rise in the nominal aggregate price level. This can lead us down a multitude of rabbit trails, but let's stay on point here. If we issue a bunch of currency to fully fund, let's say, the DOD, repair our infrastructure, pay for all the fake education out there, and stop climate change in the meantime, well, the issuance of that much currency would mean dollars are no longer scarce. And thus, nominal prices would rise and we would have inflation. MMT says that they argue against inflation-inducing issuance. They act as though they want to print more than we can handle. They say that MMT is not a panacea and then proceed to argue that it is. Notice that we have already confused monetary and fiscal policy. The issuance of the currency is monetary. Spending that money on all Congress's wishes and dreams is fiscal. This brings us to the second tenet of MMT. The theory is predicated on the idea that there is considerable slack in the market and that our real output is well below our potential output. If you actually look at that handout that I think went around, on the front page, I have the tenets of MMT listed out, and then underneath that is a graph of potential and real GDP. I think that graph in and of itself says that this assumption of MMT that we're well within our PPF is just patently false. The data just doesn't back them up. They point to unemployment as evidence that we are well inside our PPF, and we'll get back to unemployment in a moment, so keep that in your back pocket, but they're wrong on this point. GDP is almost always in sync with potential. That is because markets are efficient at allocating resources to their highest valued use. This is going to be somewhat controversial with the Austrians out there, but the third tenet of MMT suggests that there is no proportionate relationship between the money supply, the money that we push into the economy, and a rise in the general price level. No relationship between those two. In other words, MMT is saying that the quantity theory of money is false. I've got that equation on your handout as well. MV equals PQ. Jason Furman has a comprehensive review of this and shows that over a 40-year period, these are the graphs on the backside of your paper, over a 40-year period, the quantity theory of money explains virtually 100% of the nominal price fluctuations. Over a 10-year period, the monetary base, just M, just that one variable, still explains 80% of the nominal price fluctuations. And over a single year, the money supply is completely irrelevant to prices. They're completely uncorrelated. Okay? So in the longer time horizon, the volume of money and prices are correlated. In the short run, they are not. This is one reason that we say that MMT is Keynesian in nature. It disregards long-term relationships and only focuses on the short run. The upward pressure on prices and the increasing rate of inflation will cause us to hit a point where printing more money will not result in real purchasing power for the government. We call this a movement. They're trying to circumvent transition dynamics. What happens is the government starts printing money, and as that money hits the system, prices have to rise to account for it. Well, what business owners will do is they will expect that money to keep being printed. So they'll start raising prices before they need to, right? They're trying to get ahead of the curve. And so by the time the government prints a dollar, it has lost all of the value that it would have been able to purchase because prices are rising faster than the money supply now. The marginal purchasing power from printing another dollar would be less than the dollar itself. When this happens, the government will voluntarily default on its debt. This has happened in the past. Greg Mankiw correctly points this out in his critique. He says that the government prefers default to hyperinflation. I would also recommend reading Reinhardt and Rogoff's book, This Time is Different. We still have economists that are teaching out of that book. It's an excellent history of defaults, debt defaults. Third, and this is my own objection on the grounds of inflation. I have not found this in the literature at this point, but MMT argues that there is a difference between the issuer of the currency and the user of the currency. This is a hallmark that they keep referring to, but that suggests that government is one and not the other, or at least that the distinction is critical to their theory. They compare the government, the issuer of the currency, to the bank in a monopoly game. Warren Mosler actually compares them to the scorekeeper in a basketball game. But unlike the banker in Monopoly, the U.S. government is a player in the game as well. Congress is a user of the U.S. dollar. The system that we have at present is a better representation of the issuer-user distinction because the Federal Reserve is the bank and the Congress is a player. If the issuer-user distinction truly mattered to them, then the present system, not their contrived system, would be preferable. If they return the authority of the Federal Reserve back to Congress, then one of the players in the game has access to the scoreboard, and the others, us, don't have access to that scoreboard. All of this begs another question. If MMT is proposing to just issue currency in order to fund their fiscal policies, why tax dollars away from us at all? Just keep printing more. Mosler describes this best. Warren Mosler is kind of considered the father of MMT. Congress doesn't want dollars. Okay, Congress doesn't want dollars. It has an infinite number of dollars. What it wants is nuclear submarines. It wants electrical plants and agricultural goods. It wants stuff. But why would you as a private citizen want their dollars? Why would the US dollar be the medium of exchange? Well, because they tell you every April 15th that if you don't want to go to jail, then you owe them some of your US denominated currency. Mosler came to this realization through a truly Austrian realization. It was all based on human action and incentives. He told his kids they needed to clean the house, and he would pay them with his business cards. Lo and behold, the house didn't get cleaned because the carrot was rotten. So he turned to the stick. At the end of each month, his kids owed him 30 business cards. And if they didn't pay him, they lost TV privileges, access to the pool, trips to the mall, etc. The house started getting clean, which is what he wanted all along. He couldn't care less about the 30 business cards. He wanted a clean house. This is the first reason MMT argues for a tax. It coerces the private sector into producing what the government wants. But they would add it's for the private sector's good. The private sector benefits from the coercion, just like your kids benefit from hard work and mowing the lawn and doing the dishes. Coercion for the sake of the public benefit. I think we need to agree with MMT that government taxes us, the private sector, because it wants stuff. This is all true. They pitch it as a good thing. We see it as paternalism or slavery, and it conflicts with our view of the nature of man, that we are designed to work and create. If our telos is to create and take dominion, then we don't need taxes to make us do those things. Just like you don't have to teach a lion to hunt. It's in their nature. The problem MMT and Congress runs into is that without the tax, we aren't working and creating for them. Our telos is not to be slaves of the government. MMT and Austrian theory agree that monopolies result in constraints and market distortions. So both are advocating action to remove those market distortions. Austrians want to achieve this by abolishing the Federal Reserve and all legal tender laws in order to have no currency monopolist. This is actually an important point. Monopolies underprovide a service or a good. They induce scarcity to raise prices and increase their profitability. If you have a monopolist of the currency, the argument would be that they're not providing enough currency. MMT is saying that unemployment and associated underproduction is a reflection of the current monopolist acting like a monopolist to constrain the supply of currency. So they are trying to set up countercyclical policies that will force the monopolist to act like it's in a perfectly competitive market. Part of the way they do this is by returning the authority once granted to the feds back to Congress, but Congress will still act like the monopolist that it is. But now it's a monopolist with no constraints on its purchasing power. Monetary policy is a blunt instrument. It is not a scalpel. MMT is correct on that front. So on the one hand, MMT argues correctly that monetary policy is feckless at quick, targeted responses to economic downturns. As such, they argue that we need to use fiscal policy to achieve government goals. Then they turn around and say monetary policy was too effective, so we need to tax some of that money back out of the system. This back and forth is what Krugman calls Calvin ball, where you just make up the rules as you go along. I think most people just call it schizophrenia. MMT argues that we should use taxes as a means of curbing inflation. When Congress overspends and inflation starts to heat up, we can use taxation as a means of extracting excess dollars from circulation in the market. This will cool the market down so that we don't get hyperinflation. Now, it is true that taxing the money out of the system and removing the currency from circulation would reduce inflation. But at what cost? And this is my greatest critique of MMT and one no one is discussing. Kelton says in chapter one of her book, quote, "It is not the printing of money per se, but the spending of money that matters. If the government wants to boost spending on healthcare and education, it may need to remove some spending power from the rest of us to prevent its own more generous outlays from pushing up prices. One way to do this is by coordinating higher government spending with higher taxes so that the rest of us are forced to cut back a little to create room for additional government spending. And this is another thing that they insist on doing this. It's really strange to me. They say there's no crowding out. In fact, if as you read their books, they say the government actually crowds in private spending. When the government injects money into the economy, private citizens get that money and then they spend it. So they say that there's no trade-off between government and the private sector. Government crowds in spending, according to them. And then she writes this paragraph and says that we may need to lose some of our spending power for the sake of government. She's perfectly defining crowding out, but they say it doesn't exist. Okay, so a little bit of math. I do apologize for this, but since math is the language God used to create the earth and all that is in it, you should get used to it. We describe the output of the economy, that is the productivity of the country, in terms of GDP. GDP is defined as C plus I plus G plus X minus M. I have the equation on your form. I only want to focus on C and G because that's what Kelton is talking about. consumption is C is household consumption. It's all of our spending. Spending on backpacks for your kids, spending on meals out, etc. That's C. Right now, C represents about 70% of GDP. 70% of the economy is held by us, by the citizens. G is about 20% of GDP. Okay, so government spending on national defense, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, all of that stuff. Government spending is about 20% of our economy. Now think about what Kelton is saying. We should give up some of our purchasing power. C should get smaller so that G can get bigger. My question is, at what point are we no longer a free people? We have no purchasing power. The government provides everything for us. At what point does that switch really start to matter? This is why I titled my talk the way I did. MMT is not advocating the destruction of private property, but it is ultimately advocating the government having absolute control over all allocation of resources. This is the definition of fascism. Giovanni Gentile said in The Doctrine of Fascism, a book that he wrote with Mussolini, "The fascist concept of life stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with those of the state." And later in the book, he says, "Fascism is definitely and absolutely opposed to the doctrines of liberalism, both in the political and economic sphere." Thomas Sowell says this very clearly. "Socialism is government ownership and government management of the means of production. Fascism is private ownership and public management of the means of production." We completely miss fascism. Nowhere in the doctrine does it demand a military political class. In fact, it advocates philosopher kings, not generals. But it does require the government to organize society along economic lines. And I submit to you that fascism is far more dangerous than socialism, because it allows failed governance to be placed at the foot of private owners of property rather than the feet of government where it truly belongs. Just listen to these quotes. "Prices at the pump have gone up. Why? Because giant oil companies like at Chevron and at ExxonMobil enjoy doubling their profits. This isn't about inflation. This is about price gouging for these guys. And we need to call them out." Or this one, quote, "What happens when only a handful of giant grocery store chains like at Kroger's dominate the industry? They can force high food prices onto Americans while raking in record profits. We need to strengthen our antitrust laws to break up giant corporations and lower prices." Any ideas on who might have said that? Senator Elizabeth Warren. This is standard fascist rhetoric. Stephanie Kelton continues to brag about her involvement in Biden's American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion in stimulus. That came right on the heels of Trump's CARES Act, which was $2.3 trillion. So you had over $4 trillion in additional spending in just over a year. That all got financed through monetary expansion. And Jerome Powell admitted that on 60 Minutes. And it's exactly what MMT wanted. Kelton, the one who popularized MMT in Washington, is touting these as victories for their philosophy. Look at the tightness in the labor market. We did that. Look at rising wages for the middle class. We did that. This philosophy is a real and ongoing threat on both sides of the aisle. In all fairness, the Federal Reserve has been trying to contract the money supply over the last year and a half, which is helping to slow the rate of inflation. But we are clearly living in a different age, where even we, the people, are willing to be railroaded by a philosophy that appears to be written by a three-year-old. Hey, the government is paying off my school debt. Go government. Hey, the government paid for grandma's hip replacement. Go government. Hey, the government paid us a huge wheat indemnity. Go government. Our horses and chariots might look different today, but we, fools that we are, still trust in them. Even our little green idol tells us on the back not to trust in it. We made money our God, and so now the state wants control of that too. So what are the policy prescriptions? Where's the post-millennial joy in all of this? Do we decentralize the currency the way the Austrians want? Is that even possible given that the dollar is the de facto currency of the globe? Are we all supposed to switch over to Bitcoin? No. Stop clamoring for worthless business cards. Quote, you rob me of tithes and offerings. You are under a curse, you and your whole nation, because you are robbing me. Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be found food in my house. Test me in this, says the Lord Almighty, and see if I will not throw open the floodgates of heaven and pour out so much blessing that there will not be room enough to store it. On the day when I act, you will again see the distinction between the righteous and the wicked, between those who serve God and those who do not. Malachi chapter 3. Here's your hope. We know the end of the story. Mankind will return to the Father, and abundance will return to mankind. Faithfulness will beget prosperity. But this time, the sons will thank the fathers. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the George Buchanan Forum Conference. We have many more that you can check out at our website at tgbf.org. You can also find us on YouTube or on your favorite podcasting platform. In true free market fashion, we're entirely crowdfunded by the generous support of people like you. If you'd like to help our work, you can set up one-time or recurring donations at tgbf.org. The best way for others to hear about us is from their friends. So please consider liking, subscribing, and sharing our material. We greatly appreciate it.